technical difficulties as we open another Expanding Mind. Hi, everybody. This is Maja Daou, your host here on Expanding Mind. Eric Davis, the eminent and expansive, will not be joining us today as he is indisposed. But I'm very happy to be talking about an aspect of consciousness that is very close to my own heart. For me, a big, giant consciousness expansion happened when I started looking into the annals of alchemy. And I don't know if a lot of you guys know this or not, but I was a big science geek and started out getting my schooling. I have a bachelor's degree in biochemistry, so I got really into the technical, chemical aspects of reality. And that kind of coincided with a lot of my mystical research. And I kept getting pointed again and again and again in the direction of alchemy. When I would research my favorite scientific discoveries or favorite scientists, you know, you name it, Isaac Newton, Niels Bohr, everything would just head back into alchemy. So it was from that step stool that I really kind of received the biggest mind-expanding notions that really stick with me today and infiltrate the majority of my worldview. Really tends to come from my alchemical research. And so I'm very pleased to be speaking today with Paul Hardacre. Paul's going to be joining us, and he, like me, is obsessed with alchemy. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm great, Maja. Great to be on your show. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming. Paul, we met, how did we meet? I think it was through email and mutual acquaintances, right?
Well, I must have made quite an impression when we first met, because we met face-to-face.
That's right.
When you were at the PRS.
Oh, exactly, when you came in.
Exactly.
Yes.
We had just finished the 2009 International Alchemy Conference, which was in LA that year.
Yes.
And my partner and I thought, hey, you know, we're really into Manly P. Hall. We're really into, you know, aspects of the PRS legacy and current operations. Let's drop in. And we met your fine self in the bookstore.
That's
that
right.
Day.
And we had an extended conversation on alchemy.
Exactly. I think you got a hell of a lot of work done that day.
Yes.
Totally. Great work, that is.
Well, and part of why our conversation unfolded was because of the work that you do. And Paul runs a publishing company called Salamander and Sons. And all someone has to do is just go on the website, which is salamanderandsons.com, and look at some of the books you guys put out. They're absolutely tremendous and just, I think, but works that you would never find in other publishing pursuits. And they're really very, you know, niche-oriented towards alchemy and stuff like that. And I was always curious, like, what kind of inspired you to get this publishing company started?
It's a classic sort of me and Marissa. Marissa Newell is my wife of a long time now, and we've done a lot of publishing projects together over the years. I usually am involved in the editing and writing components, and she, being a graphic designer professionally, handles all of the design aspects. And it's typical me and Marissa. We just kind of get enthused about something that is really resonating with you in your life. And prior to forming Salamander and Sons, we had been running another literary publishing company for more than around 10 years, actually, by the time we started doing Salamander and Sons. So we'd had quite a lot of time where we'd been doing a lot of literary art and visual art as well, digital work and print work. And as the importance of esoteric arts and particularly alchemy sort of re-emerged in my life after a period of hiatus, it's kind of the obvious thing for us to do. And we usually do these things quite spontaneously. It seems like a good idea at the time, kind of thing. And really that's what happened in 2006. I was getting heavily involved in alchemy by that point in time.
And what kind of, when you say heavily involved in alchemy, I mean, what kind of form did that take for you? Were you actually doing like chemical alchemy or
it didn't occur to me until many years later that as a kid I'd had in my bookshelf, there was one book I had. It was called Paracelsus, Magic into Science.
Oh, that was so good, yeah.
Yeah, this quaint little, you should see the cover of this. It was like a really cheap, dodgy reproduction edition, a small kind of bestseller size, and with the worst cover artwork you can imagine, this kind of weird lino print sort of stuff. And anyway, I took that book with me, you know, as I grew up and moved out of home and moved all around different places and even different internationally. I took that book with me. And there are a few other books that were kind of markers or indicative of what was to come. And really what happened for me was I wasn't so much involved in the lab work at the outset. Mm-hmm. It was more a kind of a personal transformative experience in the most, for me, and I guess for many people could relate to it, the most genuine of ways. Because what was happening around that time, I had, my parents were ill. Both of them had various illnesses. And so what was happening was I was living overseas. They were back in Australia, and they were ill. And that triggered something very deep and profound in me. And it sounds ridiculous, but what happened was in Chiang Mai, in Thailand, where we live, there's not many large English language bookstores, but there's quite a few small, second-hand, dusty, fascinating, crowded little bookstores. Hmm. And I started this process, a kind of a peculiar process, where I would think about which of these stores I was to go to on that day. And I would jump on the motorbike with Marissa and we'd ride across town to whatever particular bookstore. And lo and behold, most times, uncannily so, some sort of unique, unbelievable book about alchemy would literally fly off the shelf into my hands.
Wow.
During this period of time. So,
but in Thailand.
Yeah, in Thailand. So we've been there since 2003, which is 9 years now. I initially went there for other reasons, some contractual consultancy work for 6 months, and now it's kind of 9 years and a baby later, and we're still there, and a publishing company too. So all of these things have been born during that time. So, I started sort of thinking there must have been something to this, because all of these alchemy books kept coming into my possession. I kept reading
them. So you were just
given
this, like, breadcrumb trail of books.
Pretty much. It felt like that. I called it the milestone. No, what do we call it? The markers. Yeah, we called it markers. We had this kind of navigational theme going on. And so gradually it started. It triggered something in me, definitely, reading this work. And at the same time, concurrent to this, through late 2005 and to mid-2006, both my parents ended up dying.
Aww.
And this was a profound initiatory Nigrido death experience for me. And it really was like a death and a rebirth, quite seriously, and it really changed the person I was. And of course, it happened also in the year of my great crucifixion, in my 33rd year of life.
Wow!
So kind of all of that came together, and it shook me up and kind of made me reconnect with perhaps some aspect of my Geminian self that I had flippantly cast aside for, I don't know. You know, it's easy to get carried away.
It's fascinating to me, that psychological component that goes along with alchemical research. I feel like that happens to most folks interested in it in their lives. I know for me, too, it was like my biggest triggers were stereotypically the births of my children and then the deaths in my family as well. There was one year where I lost five family members in one year. And like you, it just really kind of plummeted me down into it's the negredo. It's you deal with death in a very literal, physical, visceral manner, especially when they're your ancestors, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think you don't really live the alchemical transformation and process until you go through those kind of events, you know?
You're totally right. I mean, I say it a lot to people. You must have an insight into death to get it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it totally opens up so many different perceptions and ways that in the West particularly we handle or don't handle the subject of death and the reality of death, or even the subject of death, you know. So it's taboo to discuss it, yet we can watch this kind of death pornography on the news of, you know, the daily reports of deaths and atrocities. That's somehow acceptable on this very banal, superficial level. But on a sort of deeply intrinsic, personal level, to actually talk to someone on the street or in your neighborhood or in your apartment building about death, it's extremely confrontational, and most people will tend to shy away from it.
Or they'll get downright belligerent.
it's in the realms of the offensive. It's somehow kind of this offensive topic that you've brought up, and I think it obviously unravels a lot of the fear that people have because we live in this modern society that does not have any structured approach to the mysteries, for want of a better term.
No, it's true.
That may have been present.
There is no presented toolbox. And so, I mean, if you don't mind my asking, as you were experiencing that, I mean, how did alchemy and kind of your knowledge of the alchemical process, how did that help you through going through your negredo?
Well, it kind of, how could I say it? It was like a lifeline of sorts in that it showed you it was a beginning rather than an end, mm-hmm. in a genuine sense, because on a sort of transpersonal, psycho-spiritual level, but then later as I read more and met more individuals who had experience in the lab traditions, it's physically demonstrable. You can show someone that the alchemical death, the blackness, the negredo stage, is an essential part in leading to the later stages of the work, the albedo, the citrinitas, the rubido, the white, the yellow, and the red. And those, of course, are kind of applicable back to different states of mind or the inner self. But, for me, it kind of... First of all, of course, you have to go through the blackness.
Yeah.
let's not skip over that. And I mean,
that's the most epic part that is really discussed in the alchemical and shamanic, for that matter. Like, that's really where everything comes out of. But you can't. There's no getting around it. You have to go through that lonesome valley, you know. And I mean, to me, I always am amazed at people who have those tools to draw from versus, you know, folks, like you said, in modern society who just, they have nothing to draw from in order to help them go through the negredo process, and they get kind of eaten by it, and they don't out the other side.
They're lost. People get utterly lost. And, I mean, even for me with... some of these tools, which were still at a very raw stage of experience for me, I can see how you can get really lost as a person. There's also other aspects, like many other dark aspects of your personality, like sense of powerlessness, a sense of frustration, a sense of anger, and sort of how things unravel. But if you can sort of package that in a framework of understanding that it is leading to something that transcends this dark place, it certainly becomes a lot easier. And I'm not saying that once you go through that blackness and come out the other side, that it's never going to repeat, because funnily enough, I think very recently I've experienced a second round of a sort of a Negrito experience, but for totally different reasons, but it seems like it's on a slightly higher vibratory frequency, so it's not quite at those same depths of despair and darkness.
Interesting. But you can recognize that cycle when it's starting now, because you went
exactly
through it.
Yeah, and you can sort of then think back to the previous experience, and also at the same time as well, there is this for some people who are into alchemy, there is a laboratory work component as well, and
right.
I mean that I always think of the lab work as a kind of a meditation in action of sorts. And a funny example of this, which is kind of embarrassing but I hope understandable, is years ago when I was a younger guy, teenage, I was a good guy and I'd go over to my grandparents' house when they're very old and I would mow their yard.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I'd get the lawnmower, hot, sun, mow their yard. And to this day, it remains, that process, one of the most peaceful and meditative experiences I've ever had in my life. And I've studied Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga, and lab alchemy, and a whole bunch of different things. And that meditation through action, from mowing my grandparents' lawn, which you know, I guess was an expression of love, is the sort of thing that happens to me doing the lab work, and I'm sure it happens to many others. There is a connectedness between the operator, between the artist, the alchemist, and what is happening in the flasks, in the retorts, in the glassware, in that microcosm. So there's a microcosm that's happening in the work, in the glassware. There's something that's happening in you as an operator,
right?
And then that is again reflected in the greater sort of macrocosmic scheme of things, according to Hermetic philosophy, of course.
Well, it's true, and I think a lot of people don't really get that, and it's such an important component to all the alchemical material, is that there's a transference between, that's the as above, so below, the inside, the outside, that's that key concept in alchemy, that there is something that happens on one level happens on all levels. And I mean, people tend to think of science as a very like conscious removed kind of thing, but if anyone's ever done any lab work and you have to meticulously fill those dang pipettes, you know, and go through all the test tubes and make sure that everything is like meticulous and perfect, I mean, there's no difference between that and performing the act of doing an oil painting, really, if you're consciously engaged in it, or any other kind of work. And I mean, alchemy is called the great work for that reason, because it's through the work that you ritually are able to kind of get a hold of your consciousness.
Yeah, and I mean, it's through understanding the connectedness of all that you really start to make some progress, I think. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it can't be underestimated how difficult it is for many people to understand what I just said, that everything is interconnected, that the separations and the divisions are arbitrary at best. On some level, they're physically demonstrable, but on an energetic level, of course, it's like us inhabiting a giant energetic soup of four dimensions, limitless, and if you can grasp that in some way on a vast macrocosmic level, or at least try to intellectually get some grasp on that. Obviously, we can't truly grasp it in our current state. But if you can then bring that down into your life, your whether it's alchemical lab work or just your daily life, understanding that there is a connectedness to all of us, all things, that there is life in even the supposedly inanimate, like the metallic and mineral kingdom, is an important thing in alchemy. Not just vegetable matter or animals are living, you know, like there is this divine animating fire that,
right.
that gives life to all things. And I mean, these are some pretty out there concepts to the everyday person to think that a rock or a stone has a living essence.
I say this all the time, and I know maybe by repeating it, it'll get into people's heads that crystals especially actually fit under the current scientific definition of alive. You know, there's a lot of controversy in the scientific world as to what really is alive, and of course viruses messed them all up when they came along, and then the mad cow disease, which was just a strain of proteins, you know, not even like on the same level of a virus, basically exhibited the same signs, which were they're able to reproduce and they can transfer and retain information, which crystals do extremely well. They reproduce themselves and you can store and transmit information. I mean, that's how we, you know, have computers and things like that.
Exactly.
So they technically, scientifically even, are contained under the definition of what is alive. So I think, I don't understand why people's minds can't, like, grasp on to that, you know?
Yeah, I think it's, you're sort of heading in the direction of that subject area that is often talked about, which is that division between chemistry and alchemistry, or
right, yes,
science and hermetic science. You know, ours, alchemy being a philosophical science more so than, you know, an empirical science per se. But some people would dispute me on that point. I know a lot of people who are doing the lab work who take a scientific approach to everything they're doing. So it's completely documented, experimental sort of hypotheses put forward. You know, the whole, you look at their lab journals, it's just incredibly detailed. It's not just kind of hocus-pocus playing around
right.
with what feels right, man. You know, it's kind of very structured. But the difference being that there is a different philosophical approach to what you're doing and how you're manipulating those substances, including a recognition, as we mentioned before, of the connection between the operator and the operation itself. And I mean, this again is being recognized now in quantum physics and quantum chemistry. You know, the influence and the utter impossibility of separating the effect of the observer or the operator upon the operation. So I mean, gradually it seems like there's a coming around, and sooner or later, the arcs have to intersect
right.
between.
Well, and it comes back to consciousness, really. I mean, that's, like you said, the idea that there's the interrelationship through the performer and the task and the thing that's being done. I mean, that's just the consciousness of whoever is doing the experiment. And like you said, the quantum buildup in this, I mean, that it's not even coming back around. It never left the alchemical auspices. You look at folks like Niels Bohr or Wolfgang Pauli, and all of them draw from alchemical texts, and that's what inspired a lot of those ideas in the first place. You know, like Heisenberg was talking with Niels Bohr extensively about all that stuff when he was formulating those kinds of ideas. So the idea that that alchemical notion, that consciousness can infiltrate the scientific lab work, is like it's there all along, all through, like all the things that even the, like you said, hardcore scientists who are just merely like documenting it and not trying to like consciously put any kind of intention into their work.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at guys like Rupert Sheldrake and his work in morphic fields and morphogenetic fields, and guys like him are sort of perceived as these rogue physicists or rogue scientists that are really at this cutting edge, and they're kind of shunned by a vast proportion of their peers, but admired as these kind of visionaries by others. But I mean, there's a guy who's like the most, he's just a modern day hermeticist, you know, he's like,
yeah.
Everything he's talking about is absolute hermetic theory and philosophy, but using this, his own idiosyncratic kind of quirky terminology, a la Paracelsus, you know, like if there isn't a term, I'm just going to invent one.
Right.
And then here's the term, like, let's roll with that. But I mean, I think sometimes that the only hope for that intersection of the arcs, like we were saying, is if corporate science, for want of a better way of putting it, the kind of the aspect of science that has been corralled or enslaved into, you know, furthering corporatism and to some degree capitalism. Don't get me wrong, I think capitalism is totally fine, but there's aspects of it that can be damaging if not handled well, as we all know.
Right.
If these scientists who are involved in that proclaim a hermetic truth as a byproduct of sorts of some of their work, it will be believed.
Right.
It will be valued.
Because it's shown value through the work. You can see it. You can partake of it. Yeah.
But these types of scientists are valued. They're sort of like demigods in a way, because they understand these mysterious things that most everyday people don't. They help to create or confect these amazing wonder products that we all use. So if they told us that it's as above and so below, in a roundabout kind of way, we'd read it in the paper and go, oh, this is fantastic. It's as above, so below. But if some ratbag like me gets on your radio show or stands up at a conference called an alchemy conference or an esoteric book conference and starts raving on about hermetic philosophy, you know, most people would just sort of, you know, discreetly turn the other way and start reading the sports section.
It's really tragic for me how to kind of maneuver the paradigms, you know, and it's true, like, if it's not put under a certain paradigm and expressed to people, it will not get into their little box, you know. So it's like the way to get these ideas into people is, like, you do work that shows it, but then it also has to be work that fits into their paradigm, or there's just no way they can consume it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, it's happening, you know, there's like an inner turmoil in me sometimes between this very kind of a purist approach and getting valuing the tradition of hermetic alchemy and trying to preserve that. And then there's also a part of me that wants to see it more widely understood and then accepting that that means it has to be, like you say, kind of repackaged or put forward in information packets that people can ingest and assimilate.
Right.
And I mean, you see that in a few different ways. You're seeing it with the kind of the resurgence over the past decade or so, or this explosion of books on kind of transpersonal psychology and personal transformation, alchemical.
Yeah, it goes more in the psychological direction, for sure.
That sort of stuff. And then in the lab side of things, you're starting to see people who understand the spagyric approach to medicines, which is the, you know, separating the components of the medicine into its separate parts, purifying those parts, and then recombining them in a more pure and more powerful for a more pure and powerful medicinal effect. So they're taking this old spagyric technique and combining it into a whole range of different products and tinctures
Well, that's a really important thing, and I want to get into talking about that in more detail. So we're going to take a little break.
Cool.
We'll have a few words from our sponsors, and then we'll come back with Paul Hardiker on Expanding Mind in just a few minutes. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and I'm here with you today speaking with Paul Hardiker about alchemy and all of its glorious pursuits. And before the break, Paul, you brought up a topic which is of great interest to me, and I think it's important to say that, you know, a lot of people think of alchemy and they think of something that is ancient and historic and that happened, but not that is happening. And one of the great things about your work and your publishing pursuits with the Alchemy Journal and your publishing company, Salamander & Sons, is that you guys talk about and publish work from alchemists that are doing alchemy now, today, and are engaged in the process. This isn't just something that, you know, happened in basements in Europe hundreds of years ago. This is something that continues to be practiced by individuals today. And one of, I think, maybe possibly one of the most important pursuits of that is the spagyrics, like you were mentioning, which, I mean, at the heart of the majority of the pursuit of alchemy is healing and medicine, and, of course, like fixing our bodies and preparing them in such a manner that we don't have to be vulnerable to disease. And with the spagyric work, it's just fascinating that when people can undertake that kind of conscious intention in preparing medicine and isolating the substances, which, I mean, in modern day medicine, let's face it, what do people do? They go, they steal plants from, you know, the shamans in South America. They isolate the chemicals in the plants, and then they patent them as drugs, right? I mean, it's almost like they're doing this horrifyingly demonic form of spagyrics because they totally remove the soul from the process, you know. But I mean, what has your experience with the spagyrics been, and some of the folks that you know that do it?
Well, I mean, really, you're right about that isolation of these different components of plants for medicinal use these days. I mean, it comes again to that a question of approach, philosophical approach, where in the Hermetic alchemical approach, we're looking at things as a kind of a plant is a diverse encapsulation of energies, not all of which are, identifiable or measurable in according to whatever instrumentation we have at the moment, like to isolate particular chemicals and then whack those in a sort of tablet chalky filler and give it to people and say you've got all of these active ingredients of a plant. I mean, the spagyric approach, it comes from a philosophical outlook that alchemy is a labor that is primarily to benefit humankind.
Mm-hmm.
So the work of concocting things from herbs and in some cases metals, and that still happens as well, the metallic medicine, is
sure,
really...
Sure, like colloidal silver, sure.
Yeah, colloidal silver, and even Rasa Shastra, Rasa Yana, the Indian metallic medicine stream of Ayurvedic medicine. I mean,
well, and also look at like lithium and stuff prescribed for mental issues. I mean, doctors give people metals all the time.
Sure, and I mean, but in those senses, like we're sort of talking about the different ways that metals can be prepared alchemically, like highly toxic, downright poisonous metallic compounds can be so manipulated that the poison is withdrawn from that particular metal as medicine, and you're left with these incredibly potent healing tools. Which now the thing is, this is where it gets interesting, because in India is probably the best example. You have had an uninterrupted transmission of the Indian alchemical tradition, which has a plant component, it has an animal or kind of bodily component, and it has a metallic medicines component. And also, it uses a lot of plant substances with metallic substances in various purification processes to extract the toxins, as I was saying.
Right.
Now, the thing is, in India, in that Rasayana tradition, it hasn't been lost. It hasn't been interrupted. Sure, you're not going to trip over practitioners on every street corner in Madras or Calcutta, but they are there. They are practicing it.
There's still people doing it, yeah.
Now, in the West, that was largely lost for many reasons. You know, if you're thinking from the kind of fall of the Roman Empire as signaling this beginning of a so-called Dark Ages for Europe, and then whatever mystical or secret sacred knowledge, it was kind of whisked out and preserved in the Arabic empires, and then it kind of made its way back gradually across into Europe through the Moorish conquests into Spain, and then it kind of reemerged again. Now, the thing is, it became a very secret and very viewed sort of skeptically, viewed negatively, and
it
there's a whole bunch of reasons why.
It was absolutely punished in a lot of places.
Exactly, and you don't see that in the Indian tradition, although now, because of the sort of globalized culture, I guess even many Indian people would be ignorant of that component of Ayurveda, and because we tend to push Western medical approaches so heavily globally, and I've worked in public health and globally, I know this for a fact, people are becoming more and more distanced from their medical traditions of their particular geographic region. It's sad to see, but anyway, so in the Indian stream, you've got it kind of uninterrupted, there's knowledge, it's quite straightforward, there's recipes, there's approaches, but in the West, it became very confused because it was lost to some degree and because it was deliberately obfuscated by some practitioners. And by that, I mean the knowledge that was the written knowledge, that's for sure, in terms of texts. As anyone would know with a vague knowledge of alchemy, the texts are never straightforward.
Right, they're always written in riddles, yeah.
Allegorical, and downright deceptive. I mean, the red herring is employed with no shortage in these alchemical texts. And I mean, you know, I'm not saying I have an insight into what those particular authors were the exact substance when they're referring to these very arcane terms for substances, what it exactly means, and I'm sure that there's hundreds of other people who are out there into lab alchemy that might have a good idea, but then they might equally be completely off the track, and you know, the proof is in the pudding.
Well, and that's the thing, and I think a lot of people don't understand that the reason that they were constructed that way was literally so that you had to perform the labor. You had to experience the work and do it as you were going in order to figure it out. They made it so that it was not possible for a person who was not willing to participate in all the aspects of it to get the, like, kind of just get the, you know, that kind of like gem at the end, so that the discipline was required in order to get it so that you didn't use it in a kind of malevolent fashion, you know.
Exactly, and I mean, that is a question that has been asked over the centuries, where people would say, you know, okay, we've got all this misery in the world, there's people in pain, there's people in agony, why don't these alchemists, you know, reveal their secrets and help us all? And I guess one of the unfortunate reasons is it comes down to human nature, you know, and some of the insights that the adepts of alchemy have had over the centuries into physics of sorts, like a physical substances and how they can be manipulated. Well, some of that knowledge is downright dangerous, you know, and it's a classic case of pearls before swine. You know, I think that's the really short way of summarizing it. Keeping these pearls of great price, these pearls of wisdom, and kind of protecting them.
Well, and you can see, like, people will question that. They'll say, like, why would these alchemists and mystics keep this information from people? But they're not keeping it from people at all. They're just asking you to do it. They're not going to hand it to you. They want you to actually do it. Because what happens if they just give it to you? Then you're like a spoiled brat with a rich parent. And then we get, you know, a nation of entitled brats with diabetes that are all completely obese, that they all get what they want whenever they want it. So, like,
If someone walked up to you on the street today and said, have you heard of the Philosopher's Stone? And maybe some people would have heard of it. And have you heard that there's different forms of this Philosopher's Stone, but one of them is, it's kind of an elixir vitae, like a elixir of life and rejuvenation. The other one is perpetual light. So Manly P. Hall documented many of these in his secret teachings of all ages, where people had stumbled across tombs or various archaeological sites that had these eternally burning lights that were unfortunately extinguished due to very clumsy archaeologists at the time who may have just been sort of treasure hunter types. And then the third type is the powder of projection, which can supposedly transmute base metals into silver or gold. Now, if someone walked up to you and said, I've got the Philosopher's Stone, would you like it?
Right.
Do you want to see it? I think so many people would go, I suppose, and they might be vaguely curious, or they just wouldn't care, or they may have heard a bit about the gold transmutation and thought, that's pretty good, maybe I
can
get some money. And I mean, this is what it is. It's something so beyond the everyday. When it gets to that very high level of alchemical work, that it becomes utterly sacred. And the only way, and I know we started by talking about spagyrics, and maybe we can get back to that, but when you get up into this sort of the work, the great work, the magnum opus, which is not so much looking at this confection of herbal medicines and elixirs, some of which can be extremely powerful and affect rejuvenation within individuals to a certain degree. But when you're looking at this Philosopher's Stone pursuit, which is inevitably what drives most alchemists at some point in their life, it just becomes incredibly powerful. It's something that they say that you get the insights into the work either through the mouth of an adept who will orally communicate the secrets of the tradition to you, or through divine revelation.
It comes into you.
Yeah, and I have met people in both of those categories, and I guess I would fit into one of them, but you can guess which one that is. But there's incredible human beings on this planet who inspire me greatly, and who I genuinely respect the path that they have chosen for their life to pursue this work. It is the most noble path. It is the destroyer of any shred of ego that you have.
Well,
now
I was curious to ask
had.
You because I know I won't mention any names, but I certainly have met folks that have been on this path and then become consumed by power or hierarchy and utilize it maybe not they kind of, like you said, they'll go in the kind of like gold direction.
Yeah.
And then they get a little jacked up. But, I mean, in your experience, I mean, this is the most noble pursuit, but then it is also like there is that danger of usurpation by that kind of like wanting to possess it. And have you in your, you don't have to name names
yeah.
either, but have you experienced those kinds of people as well?
Well, I was just going to say I'm an alchemist. I don't name names, you know, like it's all very hush-hush. No, but yeah, it's you're right. I mean, I think it's got, it is a, they call it the royal road. You know, that's the term they use, like following in the literature, you know, following this path to the stone and the great work. And but it is a path that is a perilous one. You know, if you look into that, the Grail sort of texts and things of that nature, which are arguably analogies for many things, including the pursuit of the Philosopher's Stone. You know, you're occupying the Siege Perilous, you know, the most dangerous seat in the house. You know, you're sitting, you might be sitting on a throne of sorts, but maybe it's kind of got a trapdoor and drops you onto a bunch of spikes or something. I don't know. I'm getting carried away over here. Jet lag.
No, you go from above to below in a flash.
Yeah.
It's true.
But I have met people who you can see it in them. Like the pursuit of the work, it has enlivened them. They're just, you know, they're really on the trail of something great. And then there's other aspirants or even the same ones later at a different point in time, and it's a gutting type of experience, I think, you know, because some of the works that you undertake take a lot of time
right.
to achieve even small stages in them, and there's different paths. Some are shorter than others. Some focus on the use of heat and fire. Some use humidity or wetness. And each of them has their pros and cons. But to get through these particular stages takes a great deal of time. And I think as anyone who has ever kind of screwed something up in the lab, you know, like where you've been working on something and there's just been too much heat or, you know, not enough attention. If it's, you know, some stages of the work require such vast amounts of attention. It's like
yeah.
having a child. It's like
it
having
is,
an
yeah.
infant. You can't walk away from it and just say, oh, kind of, here's a packet of crisps and a can of Coke. Feed yourself, kid. I'll be back in an hour. You know? it's like a child. And it will die if you don't
yeah.
treat it well. So anyway, like, and then that, on a psychological level, the ups and the downs can really mess with people's heads. But yes, I know there's also a lot of people are fascinated with the aspect of chrysopeia or the gold-making
right.
part of the art. And I mean, look, this is, you know, Falconelli, the great early 20th century French adept who was potentially an amalgamation of a few different characters of that time, he termed it the little particulars.
Mm.
Now, by little particulars, he meant alchemists are permitted, according to the Hermetic philosophy, to confect or make gold or to improve base metals, perfect them to silver or gold, or to confect artificial gems or to improve the flaws in natural gems to increase their personal wealth for the purpose of pursuing the work.
Right.
So it's not like so I can go buy my new Lamborghini. It's more
so you can
like
do more
so
alchemy.
That I can just be left alone to pursue the work.
Right.
So that is viewed as legitimate. And I know that there are people out there that have spent decades pursuing the gold making. And I am personally solidly convinced that it is absolutely possible and
right.
real.
Well,
not, I'm not talking about atomic particle collisions and,
well,
and making.
Well, that's the thing. When people say they don't think it's possible, I'm like, well, transmutation happens all the time, all over our galaxy. Like, it's not.
Well,
Yeah, the thing in and of itself is not impossible, so why would it be impossible to undertake? You know?
Exactly. Transmutation is nothing more than the natural manifestation of life.
Exactly.
But the art of alchemy is in this process of quickening, as they call it. So the alchemist does nothing more than the work of nature. So we have to give, you know, like a farmer, we have to give the seed the right soil. We have to give the seed the right amount of heat, the right amount of water, the right amount of light. Now, if I understand how that works in nature, I can take a seed and grow it any time I like, as long as I have the right conditions and I look after the seed as it grows. Now, it's the same with alchemy, in that it's about doing what nature does, which is all about change, and about, there is a concept in alchemy of perfection. Now, this is something that a lot of people maybe they don't agree with it. Maybe they don't understand it. I was talking with a guy.
I think it's misunderstood a lot.
Yeah, I was talking with a guy. He was an energy working guy. He had quite a few decades of experience in that kind of stuff. And we met in Chiang Mai. And we were talking. I was talking about alchemy, and he was talking about energy work. And I just mentioned this whole process of kind of a philosophical evolution to perfection of. And in the different kingdoms, there are different states of perfection. So in the mineral and metallic kingdom, there is this idea of a philosophical gold, which is different from the vulgar gold, but it's like the most perfect state that these type of substances could attain to. Now, nature may make that substance at particular points in the universe at particular times. For how long those substances exist in the form of, for example, what we call the Philosopher's Stone, is completely unknown.
Right.
But adepts and philosophers know that we can make it, and we can make it in a period of time that is shorter than the period of time that it would take nature to confect that. So that's
the art
of quickening.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I look at it, it's no different than, you know, people making an airplane in an emulation of a naturally occurring phenomena, you know? I mean, to me, it's just like we become an aspect of nature that is able to take, you know, whatever component that the alchemist chooses, and then you emulate that and you quicken it and you make it work for humanity.
Exactly. And I mean, that said, I mean, grasping that idea is one part of it. And then it comes over into the actual work itself.
Right.
In the lab tradition.
Which is an ordeal.
Which is, look, you know, even...
It's called work for a reason.
It is. And I mean, I'm not... There are so many other practitioners out there that are years, if not decades... beyond my level of experience, who I learn from through talking with and interaction and spending time with as well. But
so
I know
good.
That
we're coming up on just a few minutes left here, Paul. I wanted to let folks know. I know that went by so quick.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm still kind of jet lagged and in my pajamas.
Oh,
so,
awesome. Well, I wanted to let people know about your stuff, and I know
sure.
I mentioned Salamander & Sons website, and then there's also the Alchemy Journal website. I would highly recommend people checking that out. It's a beautiful publication. They can find a link to that on Salamander & Sons, right?
Yeah, basically, if you go to Salamander & Sons website, you can find the Modern Magistry imprint of books, which is all of our alchemical and also broader Western Hermetic tradition books. And there are links there to the Alchemy Journal, which we're a little bit behind schedule with that one. Marissa and I have a 2-year-old son now, and so the past 2 years has been a little bit...
The great work.
Yeah. A little bit, the great work on a different level. And so the journal is We are catching up on that one, so there'll be a new issue out very soon.
Oh, that's exciting. And then your book as well that you did during your own Negredo process, which I would recommend for folks going through and experiencing that kind of death level, is that on the Salamander & Sons page as well?
Actually, it is not. It's available through, we have, actually, if you go to the homepage of Salamander & Sons, down the bottom right-hand side, there's a link to a website called Iliaster, a Paracelsian term there, but if you click on that link, it will take you to a store where you can get the book you're referring to, which is called Liber 19, and it is a book of 19 poems that I wrote during that Negredo process you mentioned.
Fantastic. Well, I can't thank you enough, Paul, for being on the show today. Thanks so much for sharing all your information and expanding our minds.
It's been a pleasure, Marja. It's great to talk with you, and I hope to see you perhaps while I'm here in the next couple of weeks.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And from me here at Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network, keep your minds open.